Arsenal for Democracy is freely available weekly at arsenalfordemocracy.com or Apple and Stitcher, and we're supported by some listeners at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy for $3 a month. The show is recorded and produced by me, Bill Humphrey, in Newton, Massachusetts. Our theme music is produced by Stuntbird. Follow us on Facebook or at AFD Radio on Twitter. The show is not affiliated with any campaign committee, and each participant's opinions are their own.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California, New York Island, the Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 392, recorded on Sunday, August 8th, 2021. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line from Idaho, as always, is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
And joining me on the line from New York City is Kelly. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Bill. Hey, Rachel.
Horses have been omnipresent in many, though not all, human civilizations for thousands of years, and they were a fact of life from the first cities and towns in European colonies in North America. When the automobile revolution arrived, horses disappeared almost overnight from most people's lives, practically vanishing in just a few decades. But up until that point, even in the most modern industrial cities of the United States in the 19th century, horses had a profound effect on every individual and American society as a whole. Vast quantities of agricultural output were dedicated to supporting a horse-based economy. They were pooping everywhere and even dying everywhere. And even the cities that were beginning to grow themselves by virtue of emerging mass transportation modes found themselves literally shaped at every level by the street congestion of horse carriages and horse-drawn rail cars, or by simple biological facts about the distances horses could travel or pull things. It is this period that we're interested in today, the massive presence and implications of horses in the modern American city of the 19th century, before the automobile age, and especially before the widespread electrification of cities and their transportation in the 1890s. In cities, horses moved people, individually or in groups. They moved mail, farm produce, last-mile merchant cargo, coal, ice, wood, heavy volumes of beer or milk, fire engines, hearses, and much more. In the countryside, they performed many of these functions, but also pulled farm equipment like plows. And now I'm going to quote here from an article called The Horse as an Urban Technology from the Journal of Urban Technology in May 2008 by Joel A. Tarr and Clay McShane. One source estimates that in 1850, animal sources of energy in the United States provided 52.4% of the total work output, and of this, non-farm or urban work animals produced 2.8 billion horsepower hours, while farm work animals produced 2.6 billion horsepower hours. These figures are probably underestimates, and it was not until 1880 that inanimate converters in the United States surpassed the power produced by horses, oxen, and mules, both urban and non-urban. In an age of rapid urbanization, horses flourished, and census and city records suggest that horses were urbanizing more rapidly than people in the third quarter of the 19th century. 19th century cities with populations over 100,000 averaged roughly one horse for every 15 people, although the ratio of horses to humans varied widely from city to city. Even where the ratio was low, however, the total number of horses could be quite large. For example, according to U.S. Census Bureau data, 130,000 horses worked in Manhattan in 1900, while Chicago had 74,000 horses and Philadelphia 51,000. These figures do not include animals working in the city but stabled outside the city, or the farm animals that trekked cityward every day carrying fresh produce for urban consumers. Now, a few other notes before we jump into this week's topic. First, we will talk briefly at various points about the arrival of automobiles as a point of contrast or comparison with the situation that existed before. But our focus today will be on the horses, because we've got some episodes coming up in the near future that touch on a very specific aspect of the introduction of automobiles, and so we'll talk a lot more about them at that point. Second, apart from the source that I just mentioned, today's episode will draw very heavily on one chapter from the massive 2016 book, The Rise and Fall of American Growth by Robert J. Gordon, which we'll be returning to in a number of future episodes. This very dense and data-heavy book exhaustively charts the American consumer economy and standard of living in the explosive 100 years following the Civil War. The first half of the book specifically focuses on the period between the Civil War and World War II, which is where we've directed so many of our episodes over the past year and a half. The thesis of that book is that an entire century, and not just the post-World War II era, were almost inconceivably exceptional and dynamic economic and technological times in U.S. and world history, and probably can't be replicated again. This chapter is useful to our discussion today because it's about the unrepeatable transition away from horses after centuries of urban omnipresence. And with that, let's jump in and put ourselves into the viewpoint of the typical urban American of the 19th century before the 1890s. What were they experiencing from horses being everywhere? Rachel, could you start us off by talking about the public health implications of horses being everywhere in American cities at this time?
Yeah. So pulling from the Gordon book, as American cities grew and gridlock of intersecting horse car lines developed in cities like Chicago, criticism focused on the inherent defects of the horse itself as a machine of propulsion. Horses dropped thousands of tons of manure and gallons of urine on city streets. They died in service, leaving 7,000 carcasses to be carried away each year in Chicago alone and carried diseases transmissible to humans. And there's a quote from another source that we unfortunately did not cite. The smell of manure heaps and the clouds of flies they attracted were some of the most objectionable nuisances that stables created. The nuisance was especially bad in the summer. On New York's Liberty Street, there was a manure heap 7 feet high. New York streets were often covered with layers of manure. And this filth of the manure and urine just everywhere in cities just caused a lot of inconvenience and disease. And here's another quote from that. Horses were ubiquitous in the urban landscape, standing, walking, trotting, sometimes shying, starting, falling, rearing, plunging, or bolting. They were large beings with which to share space. The smells of manure, sweat, and horsehair mingled with other urban smells of garbage, human waste, and industrial production. Horses contributed to the symphony of urban noise, hooves clattering and scraping on the streets, wagons rattling and banging, wheels creaking, harnesses jingling, horses whinnying, neighing, groaning, and bugling. So they were causing a lot of not just biological pollution, they were also causing noise pollution, which is something that doesn't really get talked about too much, but does contribute to a reduction of quality of life. There's the noise exacerbates nervous conditions, and it just creates a lot of unpleasantness of living in the city. And here's some more numbers from a blog post from New York Almanac. Each horse produced up to 30 pounds of manure per day and a quart of urine. All of this ended up in stables or along the streets. That added up to millions of pounds each day and over 100,000 tons per year, not to mention around 10 million gallons of urine. And these manure piles were often just housed in vacant lots around New York City. And these piles could reach 40 or 60 feet high. And it was estimated that at the turn of the century, every street would have manure piled up to third-story levels. And not only was horse manure itself disgusting and smelly and gross, it also attracted huge numbers of flies. One estimate claimed that horse manure was a daily hatching ground for 3 billion disease-spreading flies in the United States. And in winter, manure mixed with the dirt of unpaved streets to form a detestable, smelly, gooey muck. And in summer, the dried and ground-up manure was blown everywhere, aerosolized, and the smell was overbearing. And then when it rained, many rivers of manure flooded the streets and sidewalks and often seeped into basements. In 1880, New York City removed an estimated 15,000 dead horses from its streets, but sometimes a big carcass would simply be left to rot until it had disintegrated enough for someone to pick up the pieces. So that's another vector for disease, just these rotting, bloated, dead horses just on the side of the road. In the late 1800s, the city hired drainage engineer George E. Waring Jr., who had worked on Central Park, to start cleaning things up. He pushed for new laws forcing owners to stable horses overnight instead of leaving them in the streets, and he mobilized crews to gather manure and horse corpses to be sold for fertilizer and glue. What they couldn't sell was dumped, and the city tried harder. Sewage infrastructure was improved, and the first streetcar lines appeared, which were horse-drawn, but they were also able to carry more passengers per vehicle than a carriage. And in addition, public transport was encouraged and street cleaning crews were established. And there were public health authorities kind of speaking out on these conditions. One urban health authority in 1901 said, "The horse in the city is bound to be a menace to a condition of perfect health." And public health officials also charged that that aerosolized manure, that ground up manure that got flung into the air, damaged eyes and irritated respiratory organs, while the noise and clatter of city traffic aggravated nervous diseases. And from a contemporary account in Scientific American, the motor vehicle left no litter and was always noiseless or nearly so. So the exit of the horse would benefit the public health to an almost incalculable degree, which I included because it kind of shows the irony. The noise and pollution of horses was seen as worse than the noise and pollution of cars, which I just want to point out that that seems very ironic considering the urban landscape today where the car is king and there's tons of noise and pollution that comes from them. So what were some of these diseases that horses could transmit to humans? In addition to the fly transmitted diseases, things like smallpox and yellow fever, there were also the foodborne illnesses that were transmitted through contaminated food and water from the manure and urine from these horses. So things like cholera, typhoid fever, cryptosporidium parasites, leptospira bacteria could be transmitted through the urine of the horses. So there's just lots of nasty conditions that were spread just due to these packed urban environments just filled with horses everywhere. Everywhere you went, you couldn't escape being close to a horse in a city. So it caused a lot of problems, just not just the volume of manure and urine, but just these diseases that came about because of the ubiquity of the horses and the manure and the urine and the carcasses that were just so difficult to get rid of just because they accumulated so quickly. But they did create a lot of jobs, and I think Bill is going to talk about that next.
Yes, so as you can imagine from this, there were all kinds of jobs that existed solely to cater to this horse-powered economy. So you'd have people that were driving the horses, you'd have people that were maintaining and caring for the horses, feeding the horses, cleaning up the waste from the horses and the carcasses and so forth. And it just created this whole sort of secondary economy around the mode of transportation itself. So, for example, we've obviously talked a lot on this show in past episodes about the Teamsters and the enormous organizing potential of Teamsters related in no small part to the essential role of horse-drawn wagons in American commerce. Although the Teamsters did not become a union until 1887. And of course, a lot of their sort of power came from the fact that they didn't get eliminated, unlike many of these other jobs we're going to be talking about, because they were able to pivot fairly successfully to driving trucks and things like that. But I want to quote now again from that article on the horse as an urban technology from 2008. There were 8,500 licensed carters in New York in 1855. Simple two-wheel single-axle carts dominated urban traffic until the 1850s, and they were probably still an important element of freight traffic as late as 1875. In the 1850s, however, two-horse and four-wheeled wagons increasingly took over urban freight and movement. And this was partly because they changed the ratio of the horses to human driver employees in a way that was favorable for the employers. These larger wagons were driven by Teamsters, largely in urban occupation. The number of Teamsters grew exponentially between 1870 and 1900, according to the U.S. Census. In New York City, the number of Teamsters grew 311%, in Chicago, 675.5%, in Philadelphia, 350.7%, in St. Louis, 243.8%, in Boston, 412.6%, and in Baltimore, 157.6%. In each case, the number of Teamsters was growing at triple the rate that the human population grew, and increasingly urban freight operations were taken over by large business corporations that employed hundreds and even thousands of Teamsters and horses. The teaming trades required more skill than carting. Carters usually controlled only one horse that they led on foot. Controlling two horses was much more complex. Smooth handling was vital, since abrupt starts and stops could damage freight and passengers. Moreover, they played havoc with legs, the weakest part of the equine machine. Poor driving could weaken, even permanently injure, the legs of horses. Now, Gordon, in his book, talks about how there were all these businesses to provide supplies for horses. So horse-related merchants, such as liveries and harness, carriage, and blacksmith shops, were eventually replaced by automobile showrooms or repair shops, and horse accessories were gradually removed from streets, including hitching posts and watering troughs. But up until that point, you would have seen these pretty much everywhere on just about every street corner. Now, to go back to the article again from 2008, horse car companies maintained extensive blacksmithing shops and replaced horseshoes on schedule, not just when broken down, as a form of preventive maintenance. So sort of like Taylorism, where you replace all the light bulbs at once before they're, you know, going bad, so you don't have to shut down production. In this case, you had businesses that would do that, but for horseshoes. Street railway companies restricted the equine workday to just 5 hours, far fewer than those for human workers. This practice reflected the results of early trial and error testing. The constant starts, stops, and heavy loads of street railway service seemed to increase lameness dramatically in animals that worked longer than 5 hours, so the limitation was always defended in economic, not humane terms. Interestingly, according to the book from Gordon, and he was a little bit hazy on this, which I found confusing, there was one page where he talked about it in terms of land area and one page where he talked about it in terms of actual production output. But a quarter of either U.S. land or total volume of grain production, I'm not sure which, was allocated just to the feeding or the production of feed for horses. During much of the first industrial revolution and even into the 20th century, workhorse breeders were fixated on how to breed horses that were more machine-like and more efficient in terms of the conversion of less food to more power, according to that article. So if you think about that, that's an absolutely enormous amount of sort of productive capacity, agricultural capacity in the United States being devoted just to supporting horses. Now, to go back to this article, and this touches on a lot of the points that Rachel just made about public health, owners commodified horse waste also at a time when society was more attuned to saving materials. Horse waste was sent to farmers who valued stable manure and even street sweepings for fertilizer. Northeastern cities had a large number of farms on their outskirts, which also grew vegetables in greenhouses during the winter months. Greenhouse farmers prized manure in part because it gave off heat as it decomposed. Long Island farmers perceived New York City as a veritable manure manufactory. However, by the end of the 19th century, farmers were switching to chemical fertilizers. By the 1890s, stables had to pay for the removal of manure, which had been a sellable product just 10 years earlier. Even in death, horses remained a marketable commodity. Rendering firms converted their hides to leather, hair to furniture stuffing, muscles to pet food, fat to soap, and whatever remained to fertilizer additive. The corporate dimension of equine death was complex. Insurance companies would not pay if owners themselves shot their own horses. Large stable keepers, therefore, retained veterinarians to do this or relied on agents of humane societies. In the 1870s, New York's ASPCA killed between 200 and 300 horses a year. In the 1890s, that increased to over 2,000 horses a year. Urban public health boards also had veterinarians who would kill diseased horses, since the loss of a city's transportation system would imperil its human population. The owners of large stables also supported humane groups in the hopes that they would constrain any cruelty visited on their capital investments by teamsters. One veterinarian reported that the second leading cause of equine death in cities was lameness. Veterinarians shot numerous horses operating on a strict economic basis. Is this animal worth saving? Sometimes, if horse prices had dropped or business was limited, it was more profitable for owners to simply work horses to death, since a carcass might be worth more than a live animal. Rendering plants bid competitively for the right to pick up dead horses, promising in at least one case to pick them up within 3 hours. Rapid pickup was a necessity from their perspective, since decomposition could ruin many byproducts. Now, while we're talking a lot in this episode about the cities, I think it's worth thinking at least briefly about the role of horses in rural life as well, not just on the farms themselves, but in the transportation and by extension their social lives, because that serves as an important point of comparison as we think about cities. And in just a moment, Kelly's going to be talking about the urban planning implications around horses. So Gordon talks about this rural effect of horses and, by contrast, automobiles. Poor transportation kept farmers from social gatherings with those beyond a radius of a few miles reachable by horse and buggy, in contrast to urban residents who needed to travel only from house to house or from block to block for their interpersonal contact. Social contacts were few and commonly limited within a radius of a few miles. The educational facilities were meager and the opportunity to bargain in the sale of farm products or the purchase of supplies was almost absent. all this has been revolutionized by motor vehicles. The book notes that 93% of farmers in Iowa had adopted automobiles by 1926, which was already greater than the rate of urban auto ownership. The smaller the town, the greater the threat to local merchants, as the automobile allowed farmers and small-town residents to drive into the nearest large town or small city. Previous loyalties to local merchants were frayed as the circumference of feasible travel expanded. That's also from the Gordon book, and basically the implication there was that before you were kind of, when you just had a horse or you had to walk, you were kind of at the mercy of whatever your local vendor was and his prices. But once you had the automobile and could go much farther distances, you could actually try to get better prices on supplies and goods that you needed, or you could try to get better prices on the goods that you were producing as a farmer. Another thing that I wanted to note here before we move on to Kelly is that last year, Kelly and Nate and I did an episode about school buses and the history of school buses. And one of the things that we talked about was that school buses were something that eliminated the one-room schoolhouse, essentially. And I think that's what Gordon is getting at in this passage as well, in terms of talking about some of the implications in the horse era for rural life, is that it's not just obviously about, you know, buying and selling goods and services. It's not even just about the social life impact. It also has a profound educational impact because once you have automotive transportation like school buses, you can now consolidate school districts and that kind of thing. And I would refer people back to that episode from August of last year, 2020, which was episode 322, if you want to hear more about that. And that's just, again, a point of comparison in terms of rural life and sort of the implications of being dependent on horses. But as we said, we're focusing mostly this week on the urban dimension of this. And so I wanted to go to Kelly now to talk about how horses fit into what we would refer to as the walking city, which was primarily designed around pedestrian needs and demands, but to some extent also was dependent on, as has been referenced earlier in this episode, how long a distance a horse could go before it got tired, or how many hours you could have a horse operating on multiple trips before it had to go take a break. And this had a pretty significant effect on the development of cities, which were, you know, starting to spread out a little bit and get some suburban outer ring suburbs with the railroads. But in terms of the actual urban core, you know, there were still some pretty horse-dependent effects before the automobile age. So, Kelly, could you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So it was fascinating to read about and think about the ways in which this issue shaped the cities that we live in today, this issue that I never really thought that much about before. And one example is on my very own block, which is lined with brownstones and has the classic New York City stoop, where the first floor is almost a full floor above ground level. And that ground level floor is often used as an additional rental space or basement, but it's not the main living space. If you do a quick Google of Brooklyn brownstone, you'll see what I'm talking about. Stoops now are often used for having a drink with your neighbors, reading a book, enjoying your morning coffee. But originally, this design feature was a necessity so that houses were raised above the horse manure and like the runoff that Rachel mentioned that was prevalent throughout the city at the time in which they were built. And so if we go back and imagine what the world was like before the railroad, it's easy to see that folks had to live pretty close to where they worked, as they had to walk there or ride a horse there. Most cities were about 3 miles in diameter, so you could essentially walk from one corner of the city to another corner of the city within about an hour. And really, this was a problem that was prevalent for everybody. Rich people couldn't get to work fast, poor people couldn't get to work fast, so everyone sort of lived together in these condensed cities, really out of necessity because there was no way to travel quickly from work to home. Like Rachel mentioned, the earliest urban transit system was the omnibus, which was drawn by horses. And this was introduced in 1833 in New York City. And by 1853, one entrepreneur counted 3,100 omnibuses passing a single location in a 13-hour span in New York City. So that would be like having a bus come to your bus stop every 15 seconds or so. These were still slow, and you could really only go about three miles an hour. And then in the 1850s, commuter railroads were introduced, which gave upper and middle class people an option to live farther from the workplace, But most folks still walked. It was simply not affordable for most people to be commuting on the railroad each morning and evening. So the city remained small, with certain elite populations, wealthier populations, being able to leave the city for the first time. To give a sense of just how imperfect the omnibus was, I'm going to read a passage here from the Gordon book. The omnibus was expensive to run, for rutted and muddy streets created so much friction that three horses were typically required to haul a bus occupied by 10 passengers. It could take crews of men working with ropes and planks 2 days to rescue an omnibus that had slipped on the planking and into the quagmire, which perhaps is where the term quagmire comes from. The New York Herald opined in 1864, modern martyrdom may be succinctly described as riding in a New York City omnibus. Even in New York City, there were few paved roads north of 42nd Street, because that was only a dreary waste of unpaved and ungraded streets with a scattering of squatter shanties. Even in the built-up area, there were many unpaved streets where passengers struggled through the mud to read the horse cars and omnibuses. So this omnibus was really a breakthrough in urban transportation, sort of set us up for the idea and concept of public transportation, but it was still pretty lousy. It was expensive and not an effective way to get from one place to another. The fares were quite high, typically 12 cents a ride or like 24 cents to and fro. And most working class people were only earning a dollar a day. So it would be about 25% of their income to ride back and forth, which is clearly not a sustainable way to travel. And it was so expensive because of the high horse to human ratio. Three horses to 10 passengers was really not particularly efficient. One thing that listeners may want to check out is our bonus Patreon bonus episode from April 2021 about General Averill's asphalt empire, which is a history about how cities began to pave their streets, which of course would make this a lot more efficient. But alas, most streets were not paved in this time, especially as you got out of that city center. Streetcar railroads were the next improvement, and they really did improve the experience of folks traveling in the 1840s and 50s by making the ride smoother and allowing a pair of horses to draw 30 or 40 people. So instead of about a 1-to-3 ratio, you had about a 1-to-20 ratio of horses to people. This decreased the cost of the ride to 5 cents and increased the speed from 3 to 6 miles per hour. So the omnibuses were nice because you weren't walking, but you actually weren't moving any faster than walking. And these streetcars doubled the speed at which you could travel. To read again from Gordon about the results that this had on the city centers. Horse cars also introduced transit innovations that persist to this day, including a flat fare independent of distance and multiple ride books of tickets sold to commuters at a discount. Still, only 17% of employed persons regularly rode the horse cars from home to work because of the expense. The apogee of the horse-drawn streetcar occurred in the 1880s when more than 100,000 horses nationwide were engaged in pulling 18,000 streetcars on 3,000 miles of track. More than any other development in transportation, the horse-drawn streetcars made possible the separation of residence and workplace, a major change in the arrangement of cities that occurred primarily in the last half of the 19th century. Though horse cars wouldn't advance over the horse-drawn omnibus, the conditions faced by passengers were primitive by modern standards. The cars were without heat or light, and crews put a foot of hay or straw on the floor in winter to help riders keep their feet warm. Initial attempts to place heaters under the floors were rejected after a number of fires resulted, as you can imagine, if you're putting hay down. And so as a sort of reminder of what one of these horse cars might look like and why it was more efficient, these were cars that were essentially set on tracks and pulled by horses. So it had almost a railway-like track that reduced the friction, which is why horses were able to carry more people and were able to do so faster. However, it still relied on these two horses providing the power and carrying people through the city. The ride was smoother. That was great. horse car lines still had its urban planning limitations. The growing number of horse car lines really jammed up cities. Imagine having a bunch of railroad tracks through a city. And like we've been talking about, the horses created a large amount of manure and carcasses. So this was simply imperfect, but better. And again, a significant step in sort of the evolutions of cities here is that it did allow people to live quite a bit farther from where they worked, particularly people who had the means to afford these rides each day. But our horse challenges were not over yet, as horses were still quite prevalent in the city. And to quote from Gordon, despite the overnight conversion from horse cars to electrified streetcars in the 1890s, the national population of horses grew by 25% in the 1890s, for horses remained the primary means of power in both urban commerce and rural agriculture. The continued role of horses, despite the invention of steam railroads and urban electric streetcars, had the same limitation, fixed rails. As the economy grew, it was still dependent on the horse for the flexible travel to any final destination, a role that would be supplanted by motor transport starting in 1900. And it is really impossible to overstate the challenge that relying on horses in these dense populated centers presented. Rachel touched on many of the public health problems, and it was such a challenge that the first urban planning conference, first international urban planning conference, was convened in 1898 with the sole goal of discussing horse manure, trying to figure out what to do about it. This was not just a problem in New York, but in London and other cities across the world. People were genuinely concerned that these cities were literally going to be just under manure sometime soon. Almost like we today talk about the real concern that because of climate change, cities will be underwater. And so the horses brought poop and carcasses, which brought flies, which brought all of the public health problems that that Rachel talked about. And in New York City, there were vacant lots of manure that were between 40 and 60 feet into the sky. There was an estimate that within 50 years in London, the city would be covered 9 feet, basically under 9 feet of manure. And so these were some significant urban planning problems that people met to discuss, to solve. It was intended to be a 10-day conference, but after 3 days, they decided they couldn't find a solution and they disbanded. So no solution from the first international urban planning conference, but it was significant that they met just to discuss this issue. Of course, as we know, the horse-drawn transportation gave way to the automobile, which traveled faster, traveled farther, and was a more pleasant experience for the rider. And this ultimately is what solved the challenge of the production of manure and horse carcasses and all the disease that they brought with them. So urban planners never quite figured out what to do about horse manure, but the problem took care of itself when they were replaced by cars. It is interesting to note that often when looking at Googling the horse manure crisis of 1894 in similar stories of this time in this planning conference, it has sort of become a story about questioning the way in which that we are looking at problems. Was the problem horse poop, or was the problem that we were reliant on horses to begin with? And so the horse poop problem was never solved, but was ultimately sort of solved itself by getting rid of horses altogether. And so very interesting to think about sort of the lessons that might be learned there. I think in Super Freakonomics, they draw parallels to our current climate change crisis, which I do not agree with. But I do think it's always important to look at problems from multiple lenses. And this provides a very fascinating example of just that. One other thing Bill and I talked about briefly before the show was that all of these horses had to stay somewhere, right? So there must have been stables and carriage houses everywhere. The horses weren't always working, so where were they kept when they weren't working? It is true that in a number of older New York City neighborhoods, and I'm sure in other cities around the world, you can find old carriage houses that folks have sort of turned into primary living residences at this point. But it does seem that most of these carriage houses and stables were probably rather shoddy construction and have been taken down and replaced by more living quarters, either houses, apartment buildings, et cetera, as the city began to house more and more people. And this sort of infrastructure for horses was no longer required.
So before we get into conclusions here, Rachel, I wanted to go back to you so that you could comment on any of the things that jumped out to you from either your own section or the sections that Kelly and I researched and talked about.
Well, something that I wanted to point out was as this kind of transition from horses to cars was happening, there were just a lot more dangerous interactions between these different modes of transportation. And that's really interesting because that's something that we're kind of running into today, where cities are trying to encourage multimodal transportation, whether it's pedestrians, bicyclists, buses, personal vehicles, etc. And we are running into the friction between those different modes of transportation, and we still haven't really figured out how to ease transportation between different conveyances. And so that's kind of interesting in the kind of going back to what Kelly was talking about, how we have these problems, but we haven't really figured out how to solve them yet and are kind of hoping that they'll solve themselves.
And Kelly, did you have anything you wanted to comment on from the other two sections that you hadn't already mentioned narratively?
No, I just think it's worth highlighting how closely interwoven the public health and urban planning topics are today. And I think that continues for sure as we talk about adjusting to climate change and other cities that and other challenges that our cities are facing. It's just simply impossible to say something is purely an urban planning or purely a health problem. Really is worth considering these things together.
So I wanted to quote now a few sections from the Gordon book, which again, the title of that, if you missed it from the beginning of the episode, is The Rise and Fall of American Growth, and it was by Robert J. Gordon, published in 2016. And so in these passages, he talks about that transition from horses to the auto age and why it took the automobile specifically to make that transition. Because as we mentioned already earlier, I think the number of horses actually started going up at one point in the United States, even as other alternative transportation modes were increasing, like electric streetcars, the number of horses was still going up. So it really was until the turn of the century where things began to change, and that was due to the automobile. So, quote, "A basic difference between the railroad and motor vehicle, viewed as fundamental inventions in the history of transportation, is that the railroad did not replace the horse, but rather raised the demand for horses by extending civilization into hitherto unreachable parts of the country, whereas the motor vehicle directly replaced the horse and led to its disappearance as a prime mover. The steam railroad was not a substitute for the horse, but rather a complement to it. By opening vast new lands for agriculture, railroads increased the demand for agricultural horses. Though railroads expanded the extent of the national market, their mobility was limited by where their tracks had been laid. Only horses could provide short-distance hauling to and from the railroads and between points not on the railroads. Horses made the railroads useful in the first place. In contrast, both electrified urban transit, including streetcars and rapid transit trains, were substitutes for horses, as was the automobile. We have cited the counts of street traffic in cities that indicate that horse-drawn vehicles were dominant in 1905, but had largely disappeared by 1917. That short period of transition for urban streets is one of the most rapid in the history of invention. By 1929, horses had largely disappeared from urban America, though the replacement of the horse by farm machinery was not complete until the late 1950s. The transition of America from a rural to an urban society that occurred between 1870 and 1940 inherently could only happen once. The retirement of horses and their attendant street waste and disease could also only happen once." And as a bit of a coda to that, I just wanted to quote one more passage from Gordon's book, which I thought was interesting for the similar reasons to what we talked about, or what Rachel talked about earlier in the episode, where people were alarmed about how these horses and all the various horse carts and horse cars and things like that were generating so much air pollution, noise pollution, etc., and that they, you know, hoped that the automobile would replace that. There was another thing that also foreshadowed a similar feature of the dominant automobile age. Competition among drivers of competing companies led to collisions involving omnibuses, pedestrians, and horse-drawn wagons hauling merchandise. In 1853, one Philadelphia newspaper complained, "A ferocious spirit appears to have taken possession of the drivers, which defies law and delights in destruction." So with that, we will conclude our episode on horsepower in the American city of the 19th century up until the 1890s and the turn of the century. I want to thank Rachel for coming on to talk about the public health implications of horses being such a huge feature of urban life.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
And Kelly, thank you for coming on to talk about the urban planning implications of horses being everywhere in the 19th century American city.
Thanks for having me, Bill. Always good to discuss.
And before we close out, I will just note that there will not be a new episode next weekend, as I'm going to be trying to go on vacation, but we will be releasing one of our Patreon bonus episodes to the main feed that had been previously locked. So I know that some of you will have already heard that, but probably a lot of you have not. And after that, we will be returning to a number of interesting topics we've got on, you know, continuing our centennial coverage of 1921. And also, we're going to be talking more about some of the things that we've talked about today, like the rise of automobiles. And specifically, we're going to be talking a lot more about money and consumer credit and things like that, that were also huge pivotal changes in the Second Industrial Revolution period that are also really important to laying the groundwork for the economy that we live in today. So I hope that folks will stick around. Again, there will be a bonus episode on the main feed next week that we are releasing from our archives. But beyond that, there won't be a new episode. And then we'll see you again after that for more additional great new content. So thanks for sticking with us.